Turl. Now, help me round these creatures up so we can get them in the truck. 8. The truck bumped southward with its cargo of freight and despair. Collared and cinched up to a bracing, Johnny looked over the scene in misery. Patty, bruised from a fall in the melee, was sitting bolt upright, arms lashed to her sides and her back lashed to a truck stake. She was in shock and her face was gray-white. She was 8 now. The wounded horse, still bleeding from a deep blast penetration in its right shoulder, still burdened with its pack, lay on its side, legs kicking slightly from time to time. Turl had simply picked it up and dumped it into the truck bed. Johnny worried that it might kick out and break the left leg of another horse. It was one of Johnny's old string, named Blodgett. The 3 other horses were snubbed tight to the truck stakes, and their nostrils were flaring in fear as the plane fled fast below the vehicle. Chrissy was lashed to a bracing across from Johnny. Her eyes were shut. Her breathing was shallow. Questions had surged in Johnny, but he blocked them with tight lips. His own plans looked futile to him. He blamed himself for delaying his escape. He might have known that Turl had it all worked out. Hatred of the monster choked his throat. At length, Chrissy opened her eyes and looked at him. She saw he was watching Patty.
"I couldn't leave her," said Chrissy. "She followed, and I took her back twice. But the 3rd time, we were too far out in the plain. It was better to go on."
"Just rest, Chrissy," said Johnny. The horse Blodgett moaned as the truck banged over some rough ground.
"I know I was early," said Chrissy, "but Windsplitter came home. He was on the plain below the pass, and some of the boys were out to drive some cattle up, and they saw him and Dancer and brought them in."
Dancer was the lead horse Johnny had taken, a mare. Chrissy was quiet for a while. Then,
"Windsplitter had a fresh scar on him, like a puma had raked him, and it looked like perhaps he might have run off and left you. I thought maybe you were hurt."
"Yes," thought Johnny. Windsplitter could have wandered back last year, and when he tried to mount up through the passes, found them blocked with snow. He would have wandered back to Winter on the Plain, followed by Dancer. There was a deep furrow, now healing, on Windsplitter's rump.
"It's all right," said Johnny soothingly.
"I couldn't stand the idea of you lying down there hurt," said Chrissy.
The truck bumped on for a while.
"Johnny, there was a great village," said Chrissy.
"I know," said Johnny.
"Johnny, that's a monster, isn't it?"
She twitched her head toward the cab.
"Yes," said Johnny. "It won't harm you."
Any lie to calm her.
"I heard you speak its language. It has a language and you talk it."
"I've been its captive for almost a year," said Johnny.
"What will it do? To Patty? To us?"
"Don't worry too much about it, Chrissy."
"Yes, God alone knew what the monster would do to them now." There was no reason to tell her this had messed up his escape. It wasn't her fault. It was his own. He had delayed too long. The truck swerved across a broken bridge and jolted on. Johnny decided he had better tell her something to calm her. "It apparently wants something from me. I will have to do it now. It won't really harm you, just threats. When I've done whatever it is, it will let us go." He didn't like to lie. He had felt all along that Turl would kill him when he had served his unknown purpose. Chrissy managed a shaky smile.
"Old Mr. Jimson is parson and mayor now. We got through the winter all right."
She was silent for a while.
"We only ate 2 of your horses."
"That's good, Chrissy."
"I made you some new buckskins," said Chrissy. "They're in that pack."
"Thank you, Chrissy."
Patty, her eyes dilated, suddenly screamed,
"Is it going to eat us?"
"No, no, Patty," said Johnny. "It doesn't eat living things. It's all right, Patty."
She subsided.
"Johnny,"
Chrissy paused.
"You're alive. That's the main thing, Johnny."
Tears welled out of her eyes.
I thought you were dead.
Yes, he was alive. They were alive. But he didn't know for how long. He thought of Churl breaking the legs of the cattle. The truck rattled through an expanse of brush.
Johnny, said Chrissy, you're not mad at me, are you?
Oh, dear God. Mad at you? Oh, God, no.
He couldn't talk. He shook his head. The roar of the mine became louder in the distance. 9. They had been left in the truck throughout the chilly night. Churl had simply put a couple of button cameras on it, one at each end, and had gone off to his quarters. But it was mid-morning now, and Churl had been bustling about the cages since before dawn. Johnny had not been able to turn his head enough to see what he was doing. The collar and leash had never been so tight. Churl came to the back of the truck and dropped its gate. He led the horses out and tied the lead ropes to a tree. Then he bodily shoved the wounded horse off the truck, and when it hit the ground, shoved it further out of the way. It was trying to stand, and he cuffed it, knocking it down again. He came onto the bed and unfastened Patty. He had a collar in his paw, and he clamped it around Patty's throat. He pulled out a welding torch and welded it shut, and then welded a lead to it. Picking the little girl up with one swoop, he went off with her. Presently, he came back. Chrissy shrank away from him. He had another collar, and he welded it on. Johnny had a closer look at it as the leash was fastened. This collar had a red bulge on its side. Johnny realized that Patty's had had one, too. Churl looked at Johnny's eyes. They were ice blue and deadly.
Your turn in a moment, animal. No need to be cross. A whole new life is opening up for you.
He scooped up Chrissy and packed her off the truck. He was gone for some time. Johnny heard the cage door opening and shutting as though being tested. Then the truck rocked as Churl's enormous weight came onto it again. He looked down at Johnny.
Any more dummy wires? He said. You sure you're not sitting on a blast rifle that has its action dummy wired?
Churl laughed at his own joke.
You know, I am going to knock the crap out of Care for not teaching you any better.
He was fumbling with Johnny's leash and lashings.
Rat brain, said Turl.
The recon drone rumbled in from the distance and passed over with an ear-splitting roar. Johnny glared at it as it passed.
Good, said Turl, approving. You know what spotted her, and so you know what will spot you now. If you get up to anything I don't like. Beautiful pictures we get with that thing. Tiniest detail. Get off the truck.
Johnny was yanked toward the cage. Churl had indeed been busy. Several things were changed. One of them was his instructor machine and table. It now sat outside the cage. Churl yanked him to a halt. Chrissy and Patty were tied to an iron rod that had been inset into the side of the pool. Chrissy was trying to massage some feeling back into Patty's arms and legs, and the little girl was crying with the pain of returning blood.
Now, animal, said Turl, I am giving you a briefing tour, so pay very close attention.
Turl pointed to an electric connector box on a nearby wall. His talon indicated a heavy wire coming from it that led to the top bars of the cage, wound around each one, enclosed the whole cage high up, and returned to the box. Each cage bar now had insulator wrappings around the bottom. Turl yanked Johnny over to a clump of bushes. A coyote was lying there, its head muffled in wrappings, snarls coming from it. Turl put on an insulator glove and picked up the coyote.
Now, tell those two other animals to watch this carefully, said Turl.
Johnny said nothing.
Well, no matter, said Turl. I see they are watching.
With his gloved paw, Turl held up the struggling coyote and launched it at the bars. There was a searing puff of light. The coyote shrieked. An instant later, it was a charred, crackling mess on the bars, turning black. Turl chuckled.
Animal, tell them if they touch those bars, that's what will happen.
Johnny told them never to touch the bars.
Next, said Turl, taking off the glove and putting it in his belt, we have a real treat for you.
Turl reached into his pocket and took out a compact switch box.
You know all about remotes, Animal. Remember your tractor? This is a remote.
He pointed at the two girls.
Now, look closely and you will see they are wearing a different kind of collar. See that red bulge on the side of the collar?
Johnny did, all too clearly. He felt sick.
That, said Turl, is a small bomb. It is enough to shatter their necks and blow their heads off. Understand, Animal?
Johnny glared.
This switch, said Turl, pointing to his remote control box, is the small animal. This switch, and he pointed to another, sets off the collar of the other animal. This box.
And what is the third switch? Said Johnny.
Well, thank you for asking. I didn't think I was getting through to your rat brain. This third switch ignites a general charge in the cage that you do not know the location of, and that will blow up the whole lot.
Turl was smiling behind his faceplate, his amber eyes slitted, flickering, watching Johnny. At length he continued,
This control box is always on my person. There are also two other remotes in places you don't know about. Now, is all that very clear to you?
It's clear to me, said Johnny, repressing his shaking anger, that one of the horses can come over and get electrocuted. It's also clear that you could accidentally trip those controls.
Animal, we are standing here jabbering and omitting the fact that I have truly befriended you.
Johnny was very alert. Turl took out a metal cutter and snipped off Johnny's collar. He then mockingly handed him its remains and the leash.
Run around, said Turl. Feel liberty. Frisk.
Turl moved off and started picking up some odds and ends of tools he had strewn about while working. The stench of the electrocuted coyote was rank in the air.
And what do I pay for this? Said Johnny.
Turl came back.
Animal, you must have realized by now, in spite of your rat brain, that your best course is to cooperate with me.
In what way?
That's better, Animal. I like to see gratitude.
In what way? Repeated Johnny.
The company has some projects that need doing. They are very confidential, of course. And you are standing there pledging your full cooperation, right?
Johnny looked at him.
And when they are all done, said Turl, why, I will stagger you with gifts, and you can return to the mountains.
With them, said Johnny, pointing at Chrissy and Patty.
Of course, and with your four-legged companions as well.
Johnny knew a false Turl when he saw one.
Of course, said Turl, if you try to get away, which I think by now you have found impossible, or if you seek to mess me up, or if you don't succeed, why then, very easy, the little one loses its head. And if you repeat your mistake in any way, the bigger one loses its head. And if you go off the cable completely, the whole place blows up. Now, do I have your promise of cooperation?
I can move around all I please?
Of course, Animal. I'm tired of hunting rats for you, and I'm sure not going to hunt rats for those two in there.
Turl laughed, the soul of joviality. I can go into the cage?
When I'm standing outside with my little remote control box watching, yes.
I can ride around the country?
As long as you wear this, said Turl.
He pulled out of his pocket a button camera with its loose neckband and dropped it over Johnny's head.
If it shuts off or gets beyond a 5-mile range, why, I just push the first switch. You're not a monster. You're a devil.
But Turl saw clearly he had won.
So you promise?
Johnny dejectedly looked at the remote control box bulge in Turl's pocket. He looked at the two girls who were now gazing at him trustingly.
I promise to do the project, said Johnny.
It was as far as he could be stretched. But it was enough for Turl. He almost gaily tossed his tools into the back of the truck and drove off. Johnny walked over to the cage, careful not to touch the bars, and began a cautious low-key explanation of what was going on. He felt like a cheat as he did so. If ever he had seen treachery, it had been in Turl's eyes. Chapter 6 1
Leverage, leverage, Turl told himself as he went through company papers in his office. He must solve this riddle of Numph.
With enough on the planetary director, Turl could begin his own project in earnest. Wealth and power on home planet beckoned from the future. Only Numph could drop a mine bucket on him. And Turl was determined that once his project was completed, he was not going to spend 10 more years on this cursed planet. With enough on Numph, all he had to do was finish the project, obliterate all evidence, including vaporizing the animals, get his employment terminated, and there he'd be, wallowing in luxury at home. But Numph was getting a little restive. In the last interview, a couple of days ago, Numph had complained of the noise of the recon drone in its daily pass-by, and veiling it as a sort of compliment, he noted that the mutiny was not showing up on his lines. There was something on Numph. Turl was fervidly certain of it. He was thumbing through a company publication, Metal Markets of the Galaxies, which was issued several times a year. It was supposed to go to the sales department, but there was none on this planet, since it sent its ore directly to home planet and had no sales except to the home company. Yet the publication was sent routinely to all mine sites through the galaxies, and Turl had fished this latest copy out of the incoming dispatch box. So many credits for this metal and so many credits for another. Such and such credits for unsmelted ore of what percent? It was very dull, but Turl laboriously went through it, hopeful of some clue. From time to time, he watched his live screens, keeping check on the animal. The button camera around its neck was working well, and in the vicinity of the cage and nearby plateau, he had a broader view. It was a test to see whether the animal really was going to behave. The control box that monitored the cameras lay handy on Turl's littered desk. The animal so far had been very well behaved. Turl was struck by its orderly sense of priorities. It had somehow managed to turn the wounded horse over and get the packs off it. It had gotten some pitch from a tree and sealed the wound. It must have been effective, for the horse was now standing on shaky legs, a bit dazed, but munching at the tall grass. The animal had then staked out the other three horses, using a plaited type of rope that had come from the packs. One particular horse tried to follow the man-thing around, nudging with its nose. It struck Turl very odd that the man-thing talked to it, that the man-thing had also talked to the wounded horse. Very peculiar. Turl couldn't understand the language and listened intently to see whether the horses talked back. Maybe they did. Supersonic? They must say something, because the man-thing sometimes answered them. Was it a different tongue than the man-thing used to the two female creatures in the cage? Turl guessed there might be several such languages. Well, it was no matter and not important. He was no chinko, he decided, with contempt for the old race. Turl had next been distracted by the screen views of the animal when it mounted up on a horse and went down to the work area. From what he could see via the button camera the animal wore, the cyclo workmen ignored him after a brief glance. The machines went right on tearing around as always. The man-thing rode up to Care, Turl got very interested and turned up the volume. Care tried to edge away. The animal said something peculiar.
It's not your fault.
Care stopped backing up. He looked confused.
I forgive you, said the animal.
Care just stood there staring. Turl couldn't get a very good look at Care due to the shadows of the dome Care wore, but it seemed to Turl that Care looked relieved.
Turl took careful note of that as a sort of trick. It was not the kind of behavior he had ever thought about.
And then Turl really was startled. The animal borrowed a blade machine from Care. Char came over and objected, and Care waved him off. The animal tied the horse to trail after the machine and drove the vehicle back up to the plateau. Care had looked positively threatening at Char. Had the animal started a fight between the two cyclos? How had the animal managed that?
Well, thought Turl, he was just imagining things, and the screen views had been jumpy and the sound very flawed due to the roar of machinery. And Turl went back to the real puzzle of Numph.
The next time Turl remembered to check, he saw that the animal had used the blade machine to knock down a half dozen trees and pile them up near the cage. It was using the blade controls to axe up the trees in lengths. Turl was pleased it could operate a machine like that. It would have need of such skill.
Turl got involved with bauxite quotations through the galaxies and didn't pay any more attention until nearly nightfall. The animal had returned the blade machine and was now almost finished with a fence. It had built a fence of sorts all around the cage.
Turl was puzzled until he remembered the animals saying the horses might touch the bars.
Of course.
It was protecting the females from flash in case the horses short-circuited the bars. After another hour of studying prices, Turl got his face mask and went down to the cage area. He found that the animal had built itself a little hut from the tree branches and now had the instruction machine and table and packs in it and was kindling a fire in front of it. Turl hadn't really recognized that man-things could create houses without dressed timber or stones. The man-thing got a branch burning and, with some other things in its hand, went over to the cage. It had left a zigzag opening before the door to bar the horses and still let a man-thing through.
Turl threw a switch and cut off the juice to the bars and let the animal in the cage. It handed the female the burning brand, put down some other things, came out again, and got some wood and took it in. It was very interesting to Turl. He noted idly that the females had cleaned up the old robes, dismantled the meat drying rack, and neatened the place up. He checked their collars and leashes and the firmness of the pin to which they were tied. They shrank from him as if he were a disease. It amused him. After he had pushed the animal out and was locking the cage door, from nowhere an idea hit him. Turl hastily turned on the juice again and went tearing back to his office. Throwing down his face mask, Turl yanked a huge calculator into the center of the desk. Talons rattled on the key buttons. Reports to home office concerning ore tonnage shipped flashed on the screen and went into the calculator. Ripping through the sales price publication and battering its data into the machine, working with an intense fury, Turl calculated the home office values of earth ore shipped. He stared at the screen. He sat back, stunned. The operational cost of intergalactic on Earth and the current market value of the ore shipped told one incredible fact. Not only were Earth operations not losing money, but ore sold values were 500 times the operating cost. This planet was incredibly profitable.
Economy wave? By the crap nebula, for this planet could afford to pay 5, 10, or 15 times the wages and bonuses. Yet, Numph had cut them. It was quite one thing for the company to make an enormous profit, but it was quite another for Numph to lie about it. Late into the night, Turl worked. He went over every report Numph had sent to the home office in past months. They seemed very usual, very much in order. The pay columns, however, were a bit fishy. They listed the employee's name and grade and then said simply, usual pay for grade, in a symbol form. And under bonuses, they said, as designated. Very funny sort of accounting. One could say, of course, that this mine area was not an administration center and was short of personnel, and that the Home Office should finish the reports. After all, the Home Office accounting section was not only well-staffed but also totally automated. Here they just handed out the credits across a pay table to the employees. A lot of them couldn't write anyway, and there were no signed receipts. It was this omission that made it necessary to return bodies of workers killed. Then, about midnight, Turl found something funny about the vehicle reports. Vehicles in use for each 5-day work period were customarily reported by their serial numbers. The first oddity was that Numpf was reporting vehicles in use. Hardly a function for the planetary head, but Turl knew Numpf's writing. Suddenly, Turl found a vehicle he knew was not in use. It was one of 20 battle planes he had had returned from other mine sites. Those 20 sat outside in a nearby field, there being no room left in the garage. Yet, there it was. Battle plane 3-450-967G. Numpf had noted it in use for the past period. On report after report, Turl examined those in-use listings. He noticed that they varied in position from one to another. The sequence was different in every report. Turl smelled code. By dawning light, he had it. Using serial numbers of the countless vehicles on the planet, one could choose the last 3 digits and, by plain substitution of numbers for letters, write pretty much what one pleased. With expanding joy, he read the first message he had decoded. It said, "No complaints here. Bank difference as usual." Turl did another calculation. He was exuberant. These reports went to Knipe, Numpf's nephew in Home Office accounting. The total pay and bonuses of Earth should have been around 167 million galactic credits. Actually, no bonuses were being paid and only half the salary. It meant that Knipe on home planet was reporting full pay and bonuses and was banking to the personal account of himself and Numpf close to 100 million galactic credits a year. Their own combined pay would not exceed 75,000 credits. Their swindle was making them nearly 100 million a year. There was the evidence, the code, the incomplete accounts. Turl's office shook as he paced back and forth, hugging himself. Then he paused. How about making Numpf and Knipe cut him in? They would. They would have to. But no. Good as he was as a security chief, Turl realized that if he could untangle the scheme, so could somebody else. It was big money, but dangerous money. Knipe and Numpf stood a fair chance of failure, and if caught, they would be vaporized out of hand. Turl wanted no part of that. So far, he was not culpable. He could not be blamed for not catching on, for it was not part of his department to do accounting. No complaints had come his way. He had written orders from Numpf to be alert for mutiny, but no orders from anyone to police Home Office. No, Turl would be content with his own 100 million, thank you. It was very smooth. He had it all worked out. It was not company ore. No company employees would be used. He could call it an experiment and even show he was ordered to do it. Nothing would go into company records. The last little part of it was risky, getting it to home planet, but he could even worm out of that if caught. And he wouldn't be caught. Let Numpf and Knipe have their fortune and their risk. He would preserve these records just long enough to convince Numpf if he needed to. And then he would destroy them. Oh, did he look forward to his next interview with Numpf. 2. "I see you have acquired some more animals," said Numpf, querulously, the next afternoon. A jolly Turl had gotten the interview with a bit of persuasion. He was not popular with Numpf's office staff, and he definitely didn't seem very popular with Numpf. The planetary director sat there behind his upholstered desk. He was not looking at Turl, but gazing with distaste upon the awesome mountain scenery in the distance.
"Just as you authorized," said Turl.
"Hm," said Numph. "You know, I really don't see any traces of this mutiny of yours."
Turl had put a cautionary paw across his own mouth bones. Numph noticed it and turned to face him. The security chief had brought a lot of papers and some equipment with him. He now raised a warning talon to Numph, and then reached down and picked up the equipment. Numph watched while the security chief passed a probe all over the office, up along the curving canopy beams, beside the edges of the rug, over the desk, and even under the chair arms. Each time Numph sought to question, Turl put up a cautionary talon. Plainly, the security chief was making sure there were no button cameras or picto-recorder diaphragms anywhere about. Turl looked through the canopy and examined the outside carefully. No one was around. Finally, he smiled in reassurance and sat down.
"I don't like that recon drone crashing by every morning," said Numph. "It gives me a headache."
Turl made a notation.
"I will change its course at once, your planet ship."
"And these animals," said Numph. "You're getting a positive zoo out there. Just this morning, Char said you had added 6 more."
"Well, actually," said Turl, "the project requires more than 50. Also, some machines to train them and authorization."
"Absolutely not," said Numph.
"It will save the company a great deal of money and increase its profits."
"Turl, I am going to issue an order to vaporize those things. If Home Office were to hear..."
"It's confidential," said Turl. "It's a surprise. How grateful they will be when they see their payroll and bonuses shrink and their profits soar."
Numph frowned, feeling himself on very sure ground. Turl knew the blunder he had made before. Numph, left to his own crooked course, would have enormously increased the number of personnel brought here from Cyclo. Every extra employee greatly padded Numph's pocket.
"I have other ways of increasing ore shipments," said Numph. "I am considering doubling our workforce with employees from home planet. There are plenty out of work there."
"But that will reduce profits," said Turl innocently. "You told me yourself that profits were a battle just now."
"More ore, more profits," said Numph belligerently. "And they go on half pay when they arrive. That's final."
"Now, these authorizations I have here," said Turl, undisturbed, "to train up a native indigenous workforce."
"Did you hear me?" said Numph angrily.
"Oh, yes, I heard you," smiled Turl. "My concern is for the company and the increase of its profits."
"You imply mine is not?" challenged Numph.
Turl laid his work papers on the desk in front of Numph. At first, the planetary director started to sweep them away with a paw. Then he sat suddenly still, frozen. His eyes stared. His paws began to tremble. He read the profit estimations. He read the circled absence of actual pay information. He read the vehicle numbers, and then he read the message, "No complaints here, bank difference as usual." Numph looked up at Turl. Staring, frozen terror crept into his eyes.
"By company regulations," said Turl, "I have the right to replace you."
Numph was staring at the gun in Turl's belt. His eyes were hypnotized with shock.
"But actually, I don't care much for administration. I can see that someone in your position, faced with growing old and with no future, might find other ways to solve his problems. I am very understanding."
Numph's terror-filled eyes lifted to Turl's chest, waiting.
"The crimes of someone on home planet are not in my duty sphere," said Turl.
There was a flicker in Numph's eyes. Incredulity.
"You have always been a good administrator," continued Turl. mainly because you let other employees do exactly what they think best serves company interests.
He swept up the evidence.
Out of regard for you, these will be put away where none can see them. Unless something happens to me, of course. I will report nothing to Home Office. I know nothing about this. Even if you say I do, there will be no evidence and you won't be believed. If you get vaporized because of it, it will be entirely because of mistakes you make on other lines. They will not include me.
Turl got up, followed by Numpf's stricken eyes. A huge sheaf of requisitions and order forms was laid on Numpf's desk.
For your signature, said Turl.
They were blank. They were undated. They were forms from the planetary director's own office. Numpf started to say,
But they're blank. You could put anything on these. Personal money, machines, mines, change operations, even transfer yourself off the planet.
But his voice wouldn't work. And then he realized that his brain wouldn't function either. The pen was pushed between his claws, and for the next 15 minutes, Numpf signed his name over and over and over again. Slowly, almost witlessly. Turl picked up the sheaf of signed blanks. He would be very sure that none of these got loose while they were not filled in.
All for the good of the company, said Turl.
He was smiling. He put the thick sheaf in a securely locked case, put the evidence in a big envelope, picked up his equipment.
To remove you would ruin the career of a valuable employee. As your friend, I can only seek to minimize damage to the company. I am pleased to tell you that you are in no danger of any kind from me. You must believe that. I am a faithful company employee, but I protect my friends.
He gave a little bow and left. Numpf sat like a dumped sack of ore, nerveless, incapable of reaction. Only one thought kept going round and round and round in his head. The security chief was an untouchable demon, a demon who, forever after, could do exactly as he wished. Numpf never thought of even trying to stop him. He was, and forever after would be, in the complete power of Turl. He was too paralyzed to even think of warning Nipe. From here on out, Turl would be the real head of this planet, doing exactly as he pleased. 3. It had been a good hunt, and Johnny was going back to the compound. That morning, he had looked with sorrow at the dejected bearing of the two girls. What little they could do to clean up their squalid cage, they had done. They had tried to put on bright faces when he talked to them through the two barricades. Patty had come out of it a bit more, but she hadn't laughed when he told her she would marry the King of the Mountains. It was an old personal joke. She had suddenly burst into tears, and Chrissy, trying to comfort her, had begun to cry too. Something had to cheer them up, or at least keep them busy, Johnny thought. He got the horses, and with Windsplitter stepping out, had ridden away from the compound. Dancer and the third horse, named Old Pork, after his habit of grunting, trailed behind. Blodgett was better, but it would be some time before the wounded horse could run. Johnny was looking for deer. With venison to smoke and a hide to tan and strip, the girls would get their minds off their worries. Some of his own guilt and bitterness dimmed as he raced across the plain, Windsplitter eager, the other two pounding along behind. The wind had wiped some of his pessimism away. The illusion of freedom stimulated him. Perhaps there was hope. He had done better than one deer. He had come hammering into an arroyo and found himself within feet of antelope. And shortly after, one cleaned antelope was on the back of Old Pork. Not a half hour later, he had gotten his deer, a young buck. With both pack horses laden and trailing behind him, he was looking for kinnikinick, a wild plant that gave good flavor to venison. It was really too early for the berries to form, but the leaves were good. His attention was drawn to a humming sound far behind him. He halted, examining the sky. There it was, a tiny dot getting bigger. It was heading either toward him or toward the compound. The horses had gotten to machinery sounds, and there was not much to choose at the moment between the buzz overhead and the mutter of noise in the compound not 3 miles ahead of them. Johnny's curiosity turned to a feeling of unrest. Where was that object going? It was very low, not traveling very fast now. Suddenly, he knew it was heading for him. There had been a row of planes in a field near the compound, 20 of them that Turl had ferried in and left in the open. This was one of them. It was about 100 feet up, almost stopped. The roar was making the horses nervous. Johnny kicked Windsplitter ahead and started straight for the compound. The plane drew off, turned, and then, with a shattering burst of speed, dove on him. The earth before the horses erupted in explosions of dirt. Windsplitter reared and tried to spin away. Clod spattered the horses. Johnny's ears ached with the explosions. He turned the horses in another direction, to the right. The earth erupted in a long line in front of him. Windsplitter began to plunge in terror. One of the pack horses broke loose. Johnny wheeled and began to race to the north. In front of him, the ground again erupted. He tried to get his horse to go through the hanging curtain of dust. Windsplitter turned and tried to run away to the south. This time, the plane plunged down and settled across their path. Terrified, Windsplitter reared. Johnny got him under control. Turl was sitting in the open door of the plane, laughing. He roared, moving back and forth, pounding his chest to get his breath. With considerable trouble, Johnny got the two pack horses together. He dismounted to straighten their packed meat.
"You looked so funny," gasped Turl, straightening his face mask.
The horses were rolling their eyes, trembling. But Johnny's eyes were not rolling. Had they been blast guns, Turl would have been dead.
"I just wanted to show you how easy it is to stop you if you ever got out of hand," said Turl. "Just one of those gun blasts, aimed at you and not in front of you, would have made you a pale pink mist."
Johnny had tied the pack horse lead ropes to Windsplitter's neck. He stood there, soothing Windsplitter with a stroking hand.
"I'm celebrating," said Turl. "Send those horses back to the compound and get in."
"I don't have an air mask," said Johnny. "That interior will be breathe gas."
"I brought your air mask," said Turl, reaching inside and holding it up. "Get in."
Johnny had Windsplitter calm now. He took hold of the horse's ear.
"Go to Chrissy," he said.
Windsplitter cast a glance at the plane and then, glad enough, started off toward the compound, pulling the pack horses with him.
"Yes," Turl told himself, "the animal did have a language with other animals."
Johnny put on the air mask and pulled himself up into the plane. 4. Badly as it had started, Johnny could not believe the sensation of flight. He was lost in the huge co-pilot seat, and the belt that was supposed to keep him in would not contract enough to do so. But he braced himself with a grip on a handhold and watched the earth race away from him. He felt awe. Was this how it was to be an eagle? Is that how the world looked from the sky? The panorama of the mountains to the west began to open in relief. And in a few moments, he realized they were now higher than High Peak, seen whitely in the cold, clear air. For 15 minutes he was enthralled. They were at a height of about 4 miles. He had never realized there was so much world, or that one could feel so thrilled. Then Turl said,
"You can operate any of the mind machines, can't you, animal? Now, this is no different, except that it goes in 3 dimensions, not just 2. Those controls in front of you duplicate these. Fly it."
Turl's paws came off the controls. The plane immediately flopped over. Johnny was thrown against the door. The plane staggered and began a sickening dive. Johnny had not paid any attention to what Turl was doing with the controls before. They were a maze of levers and buttons. He gripped the security belt and got himself into position to reach things. He started pushing buttons. The plane went crazy. It soared. It swooped. The ground rushed up and sped away. Turl's laughter cut above the roar. Johnny began to realize the creature was a bit high on Kerbango. Celebrating indeed. With a steady concentration, Johnny looked at the controls. As on all Cyclo equipment, everything was marked. Some of the terms he didn't know. But he spotted an additional button alongside every button familiar in mining machinery. He grasped that the third set was for the third dimension. The main thing, he instinctively knew, was not to get too close to that ground. He found a button for altitude and punched it. Although the plane was staggering, the ground began to fall away. This was too close to a win for Turl.
"I'll take over," he said. "I got high honors as a pilot at the school. Watch me land on that cloud."
A ragged top puff of cloud was ahead of them. Turl punched some buttons and stopped the plane on a flat place in the mist.
"Trouble is, Ratbrain, you didn't watch what I was doing. You were too busy gawking at the scenery. But I guess if rats had been meant to fly, they'd be birds."
He laughed at his own joke, reached behind his seat, and unstrapped a sealed container of Kerbango. He took a chomp on it and put it back.
"First lesson, don't ever leave anything adrift in a plane. It'll fly around and bat your brains out. Not," he added with more laughter, "that rats have brains."
He took off and made Johnny repeat the operation of landing and stopping. After the third attempt, Johnny made it without being half down in the cloud. Johnny took off and started to fly toward the mountains. Turl instantly, and Johnny thought a bit fearfully, batted his hands away from the co-pilot controls and with his own turned the plane back.
"Not while I'm with you," growled Turl. His mood changed.
"Why not over the mountains?" asked Johnny.
Turl scowled.
"Whenever you fly over those mountains, just make very sure you got no breathe gas loose any place. Understand?"
Johnny understood. He suddenly understood a lot more than Turl thought he did. "Why are you teaching me to fly?" asked Johnny, more to distract Turl from his line of thinking than because he believed Turl would tell him. He was right.
"Any miner has to know how to fly," said Turl.
Johnny knew that wasn't true. Kerr could fly, he was sure, since Kerr had said so. But Kerr had also said other miners were only interested in going underground, not above it. It was mid-afternoon when they landed the battle plane at the end of the row. Johnny had been right. It was the 20th plane. Turl inched it into precise position. He put on his breathe mask, opened the door, and gave Johnny a shove to get out.
"Don't get any ideas that you can start one of these things," said Turl. "They require a special key to unlock the computers."
He dangled a key in front of Johnny.
"I keep the one to this plane right here beside the remote control box."
He took the box out and looked at it.
"Yep, all switches still open."
He showed Johnny the box.
"And no dummy wires," he laughed loudly. "That's pretty good, no dummy wires."
Johnny went off to round up his horses. Windsplitter had gone to Chrissy, and the three horses were standing outside the wooden barrier. Patty yelped to see him. He realized they had been worried by the horse showing up without him. "Got an antelope and a deer," Johnny called into the cage. "I was a little delayed looking for kinnikinick. I found some, not very much, but it will flavor the meat." Chrissy was very pleased.
"We can strip and smoke the meat," she called across the two barriers. "There's plenty of ashes here, and we can tan the hides."
Johnny felt better.
Patty called, "Johnny, there's a huge grizzly bear skin in here. Did you kill it, Johnny?"
Yes, Johnny had killed it. But he was not so sure that he hadn't killed the wrong beast. Later that evening, when Turl came to let him, supervised, into the cage, he gave the girls the skinned meat and hides to handle. He touched them reassuringly, hiding his wince at the way the collars chafed their throats. When he came out and Turl had locked up and turned the juice back on, Turl said,
"I'm just an animal attendant, but I don't wire dummy wires."
He threw a stack of books at Johnny before he rumbled away.
"Get your rat brain around these, animal. Tonight, Care will take up your instruction in the morning, so don't go chasing off on a rat hunt."
Johnny looked at the books. He was dimly getting an idea of what Turl must want out of him. The books were Beginner's Flight Manual and Teleportation in Relation to Manned and Drone Flight. The latter was clearly marked Secret, not for alien race distribution. Could it be, thought Johnny, that Turl was acting well outside the business of the company? If so, it was doubly certain that he and the girls would be killed when they had served their purpose. Turl would not leave witnesses around. 5. Johnny and Care were engaged in ferrying mining machines and equipment to the defense base. The order to do so had come early that morning from Turl. The machinery freighter plane was parked with doors agape and ramps let down in the open field near the battle planes. A remarkably cowed zzt checked off a drilling machine as it was run up the ramp by Care. He raised the ramps and closed the doors. Johnny buckled himself into the co-pilot's seat, and Care slid behind the controls. The freighter lifted abruptly and spun to the west. Care flew low and kept the ship steady, for none of the machinery was lashed. Johnny did not even look at the ground flowing by. They had made this short trip several times. He was tired. For a week, he had been practicing flying all day and studying all night, and it was beginning to show. His headache, however, came from the text Teleportation in Relation to Manned and Drone Flight. The flight part of it was far less interesting than teleportation. He felt that if he could grasp that, he might be able to do something to avert the fate he knew would come someday. The mathematics of the text were quite beyond him. They were cyclomathematics, a long way in advance of what he had studied. The symbols made his head spin. The history section at the start of the book was perfunctory. It simply stated that 100,000 years ago, a cyclophysicist named N had untangled the riddle. Prior to this, it was thought that teleportation consisted of converting energy and matter to space and then reconverting it in another place so it would assume its natural form. But this had never been proven. N had apparently found that space could exist entirely independent of time, energy, or mass, and that all these things were actually separate items. Only when combined did they make up a universe. Space was dependent only upon three coordinates. When one dictated a set of space coordinates, one shifted space itself. Any energy or mass contained in that space thereupon shifted with that space shift. In the matter of a motor such as this freighter had, it was just an enclosed housing in which space coordinates could be changed. As the coordinates changed, the housing was forced to go along, and this gave the motor power. That explained why these planes were run by a switchboard and not a thrust through the air. They didn't have to have wings or controls. Much smaller housings in the tail and on each side had similar sets of coordinates fed into them to climb and bank. A series of coordinates were progressively fed to the main motor, and it simply went forward or backward as the housed space occupied each set of coordinates in turn. Teleportation over vast distances worked the same way. Matter and energy were pinned to the space, and when it was exchanged with another space, they simply changed too. Thus, matter and energy would seem to disappear in one place and appear in another. They didn't actually change, only the space did. Johnny could see now how Earth had been attacked. Informed in some way of its existence, possibly from some cyclo station in this universe, the cyclos had only to fish in its coordinates. They evidently used a recorder of some sort. They cast the recorder out to a test set of coordinates, and then got it back and looked at the pictures. If the recorder vanished, they knew they had sent it into the mass of the planet. Then they just had to adjust the coordinates for a new recorder cast. In that way, they had sent the killer gas. When it dissipated, they had followed it with cyclos and weapons. That was how Earth had been wiped out and conquered. But it didn't tell Johnny how to reverse the process. Any cyclo station out there could transport new gas, or even an army to Earth at will. That was the point that was giving him a headache.
"You're not very chatty," said Care, circling to land at the old defense base, going dead slow because of loose machinery. Johnny came out of it. He pointed at the button camera that hung around his neck.
"Forget it," said Care to his astonishment. "They only have a range of about 2 miles."
He pointed at his work jacket pocket flap. A much smaller button camera with the symbol of the company on it was actually serving as a real button.
"Not 5 or more?" asked Johnny.
"Crap, no," said Care. "The security measures of this company are a pain. There's no recorder in this plane. I checked. What the splintered asteroid are we doing hauling this machinery over to this old defense base?"
He looked down.
"It doesn't even look like a defense base anyway."
And it didn't. It was just some buildings, not even a landing field. No bunkers anyone could see. Some kind of a strange series of pointed things standing up at one end.
"Turl gives the orders," said Johnny, a bit resigned.
"Blast, no. These weren't Turl's orders. I saw them. They were signed by the head of the planet. Turl was even complaining. He said he wondered whether old Numph had gone off his computers."
It gave Johnny new data, but not what Care thought. Turl was covering his tracks. This was Turl's project. It made him uneasy.
"This stuff," said Care, with a backward jerk of his head, "is supposed to be practice equipment. But for who? It's perfectly good mining equipment. Hold on, we're going to land."
He pushed the console buttons and the freighter crept down and landed easily and level. Care put on his face mask.
"Another funny thing. There's no supply of breathe gas with any of this stuff. Just what was left in their tanks. You're the only one I know that can operate these machines without breathe gas in the canopies. You're going to operate all these machines?" He laughed. "It'd sure run your butt off. Let's unload."
They spent the next hour lining the machines up in an open field near the largest building. There were drillers and flying platforms, cable reelers, ore netters, blade scrapers, and a single transport truck. With the items brought in earlier loads, there were over 30 machines now.
"Let's prowl," said Care. "We've been fast. What's in this big building?"
It consisted only of rooms, rooms, and rooms, each with bunks and lockers. There were what may have been washrooms. Care was prowling for loot, but broken windows and wind and snow had not left much. Dust and indistinguishable debris were thick.
"Already been prowled," was Care's finding. "Let's look elsewhere."
Care clumped through the entrance of another building. Johnny saw that it had been a library, but without Chinko protection, it was mainly litter. 1,000 years of cockroaches had dined on paper. A queer, broken structure that once had had 17 points, Johnny counted them, seemed to have been some kind of a monument. Care entered a door that was no longer there. A cross was still hanging on a wall.
"What's that thing?" said Care.
Johnny knew it was a church cross. He said so.
"Funny thing to have in a defense base," said Care. "You know, I don't think it was a defense base. More like a school."
Johnny looked at Care. The midget cyclo might be thought dim-witted, but he was dead on the mark. Johnny did not tell him there were signs all over the place that said United States Air Force Academy. They wandered back to the freighter.
"I bet we're establishing a school," said Care. "I bet that's what it is we're doing. But who's going to be taught? Not cyclos with no breathe gas, that's for sure. Put up the ramps, Johnny, and we'll get out of here.
Johnny did, but he didn't climb up to the cockpit. He looked around for water.